Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and the great state of Virginia, where Ronnie is this evening. Tonight's broadcast brings you author Chris Kyle, who wrote the number one bestseller titled American Sniper, the autobiography of the most lethal sniper in U.S. military history. More with Chris Kyle and his book in just a few minutes. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director and publisher. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is a just-released documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Get out there and buy his books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed. Also, be sure to visit him on Twitter and Facebook. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio of my co-host. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay, Canada area, with Volume 2 coming out next year. And this summer, we will publish another book about the famous Ganella shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Always a good promo. Our book, Movers and Mavericks, is selling like ice-cold beer on a hot day in Coney Island. Thank you very much, Ronnie.
Sounds good.
Now, this week's show features Chris Kyle, the subject and author of American Sniper. It's the inside story of what it's like to be in war, a brave warrior and a patriot. Chris Kyle writes frankly about the missions, personal challenges, and hard choices that is part of the daily life of an elite SEAL sniper. Now, I just also wanted to mention that Nancy and Lisa from the Chit Chat Cafe on the Artist First World Radio Network interviewed Chris Kyle's wife several weeks ago. It was a great interview, and you can catch it on their archive page. Well, Ronnie, it's going to be a great show tonight, so we invite all our listeners to stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one. Now, just before we reach into our mailbag, I'd just like to thank all our listeners from around the globe that tune into Crime Beat. We're getting over 130,000 listeners every week from more than 100 countries, and that's really certainly something to cheer about. I'd like to thank our production people, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony, for making the show possible. Also, a special thanks to the Ryan Brothers for allowing us to use their music as our theme song. Like I said many times, Ronnie, internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Well, Ronnie, now here is this week's mailbag. This one is from Raymond of Dallas, Texas, who writes, "Prison is too good for the slumbag, good-for-nothing Joran Vandersloot. He should be dragged out of prison in Peru and thrown off a 20,000-foot Andes mountain cliff." Doesn't mince any words there, Ronnie. Now, this one is from Hui of Hong Kong, who writes, "Your interview with Lisa Pulitzer and Cole Thompson was certainly illuminating. The story of Joran Vandersloot and the young girls he murdered is horrific. It must be unbelievable anguish for the parents of Natalie Holloway, whose body was never recovered." I'm looking forward to reading that book very soon. Any remarks, Ronnie?
Yes, Willie. It was a chilling read, but it was a great book and provided a lot of new details about Joran Vandersloot and the Flores and Holloway. murders, and hopefully he's going to be extradited to the U.S., and we'll be able to maybe get the information that the Holloway family needs to have some closure, you know, with their daughters. It just must be a horrific experience not to know what happened to your daughter.
Absolutely. We'll keep an eye on that story. Well, Ronnie, I hear you were in New York City last night. tell us about that.
Yeah, I was in a Big Apple at the Museum of the American Gangster, and we were premiering our new documentary, the one on Frank Matthews, and it was a lot of fun. We had a great crowd. It's a great theater, and
great.
A lot of great exhibits, you know, on the mafia and some of the other great chapters in American crime history. And I would recommend it for anybody to visit when they're in the Big Apple. And tonight I'm in Virginia. We're on our way back. I'm with Ike Atkinson, and he's tuning into the program as well. So we're looking forward to this show with Chris Kyle.
You bet. Well, give Ike my best regards, and I'm sure you're going to get a lot of play from that New York visit. Well, Ronnie, I'll tell you, you want to give our listeners out there in the wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show, please.
Yes, sir. We have John Lennon and Robert Fitzpatrick, the authors of Betrayal, Woody Bossier and the FBI who fought to bring him down. And it's an incredible story of corruption in the FBI office and at what lengths certain agents in that office went to protect Woody Bossier, who's going to be standing trial later on. And this was a real hero, Robert Kirkpatrick. He stood up against the system and unfortunately paid for it. But it's a great read, and we're looking forward to learn more about Woody Bossier, new information about him. He's still one of the most fascinating but despicable specimens from organized crime in the United States.
Absolutely. That's going to be a great show. All our listeners are urged to tune in. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet features a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Now, here is this week's rap sheet item number one. Dateline, April 11th, 2012, Los Angeles, California. Infamous mass murderer Charles Manson just loses last real shot at freedom. Hey, Ronnie, at yesterday's parole board hearing, Charles Manson was denied his latest request for release. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, he's been trying to get out of jail. Could you imagine that, Charles Manson? And this evidently is his last parole hearing, and he won't have another one until 2027, and he'll be 92 years old. Mm-hmm. And he's really hadn't shown any effort at contrition, you know, for the murders, and he's still as crazy as ever. He's talking with a psychiatrist, and he said things like he's still a very dangerous man, killed five people. He admitted that, and he didn't even show up for this hearing because he knew that he wouldn't get out of jail. And it took him about 20 minutes to decide to keep him in jail for another 24, 25 years.
Well, the guy still gets
15,
a lot of
15 years.
15 years, that's right. But he still gets a lot of mail, and he gets more mail than you, Ronnie.
Well, it's a toss-up.
You bet. Hey, well, let's get on a rap sheet item number two. Dateline, March 30th, 2012. Vatican City, Italy. Vatican declares mafia is anti-human and anti-religious. Hey, Ronnie, the Vatican has announced a harder line against the mafia, whose sociopathic members often wrongly assume their nominal Catholicism will save them from eternal damnation. Hey, what's your take on this?
Well, I'm telling you, the mafia don't listen to, don't seem to be afraid of the Catholic Church. Last week, suspected mafia bosses joined an Eastern celebration in the Italian region of Calabria, even though the Church forbid them to do that. And the Church has had a bad record when it comes to standing up against the mafia. And so they're trying to make amends. You know, they've got a real PR problem with all the abuse that's gone on in the church and some of the corruption problems with money that have involved money laundering.
Yeah, well, I hope they put a dent into that, into the mafia world of crime. Now, just before we get on to our featured guest, Chris Kyle, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network, wherever you are tonight. We hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have any questions for our guests, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you and try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. While running, Crime Beat's featured guest tonight is Chris Kyle. In the community of elite warriors, one man has risen above the ranks and distinguished himself as unique. Chris Kyle is that man, a master sniper with 160 confirmed kills. Chris Kyle has done and seen things that will be talked about for generations to come. He is the deadliest American sniper. He was called the devil by the enemies he hunted and the legend by his Navy SEAL brothers. It's going to be a great show, Ronnie, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Chris Kyle.
Well, thank you, sir, for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I'll tell you, you've got a heck of a book. I read it, and it's a great book and number one bestseller, so we congratulate you on that. Did you really, in your wildest imagination, think that your book would do as well as it has done?
Not at all. I figured the book would do okay, just, you know, kind of with the military-type people, but I never imagined it would branch over into all these different reader groups and just stay on this New York Times list ever since it's come out.
Yeah. Right. It really struck a chord, hasn't it? I mean, not just people interested in military history, on foreign affairs, all kinds of people, you know, from elderly ladies and book clubs to, various other types of individuals have found your book fascinating, right?
Yes, sir. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, this isn't a military book that I'm sitting here beating my chest saying, hey, look at me, I'm great.
Right.
And I'm putting the story out about my heroes, the guys who served with me. And then also the fact that, my wife's in it telling her side, you know, talking about everything that she went through. And this book is not unique to just me. It's what all combat vets go through. So I think people are seeing that and recognizing it. So it turned out to be great.
Right, and of course, you know, you had two co-authors, Jim DeFelice, is that the way you pronounce his name?
DeFelice.
Right, and Scott McCune, and our hats off to them, too. They did a really great job. It must have been tough for you sitting down and telling your story. You're a man of action, you know, you're out in the field and all that, to sit there. I know, because I've ghost-written books with people that had stories to tell, and it's a long, arduous process.
It definitely was long. I had to spend a lot of extended periods of time with the author and, you know, especially Jim DeFelice and getting my story out there. But, you know, people also tend to forget this wasn't a happy-go-lucky book. It was some of the best times of my life, but it was also the worst moments of my life. And so, you know, there's a lot of times I felt extremely stressed and sore at the end of that time spending with the author.
Right. And we'll talk about that later, the highs and the lows, but it must have been cathartic too, I guess, right? It gave you a chance for self-reflection and look at some of the things you've done in your life and to evaluate them.
Yes, I mean, you always look back on things, and hindsight's always, you know, 20/20, so you always look back and think you could have done things a little different and, you know, maybe someone else would be here or whatever, mm-hmm. But I also think things work the way they do because God has a plan, and you know there's not much you can do to change it. You're living it.
Right, and you have to move forward, right?
Yes, sir.
Right. Well, you've got a really interesting background. I was reading about your background. The book talks about it. You know, you're from Texas. You learned marksmanship, right, when you were hunting on your childhood hunting trips with your father. What was your childhood like?
Oh, I mean, it was, my dad was definitely an extremely loving man, but he was definitely rough and hard on me and my brother. But, you know, we grew up shooting guns, riding horses. We were working cattle while we were growing up and learned to ride about the age of three. And it just kept continuing from there. And then, of course, going out hunting and spending time with the family. And that was the perfect time, just being able to spend time with them, and seems like meals always taste better on an open fire.
that's true. But you've got a real interesting background. You're a saddle bronc rider, prior to joining the Navy. And were you a professional rider?
I did for a little while. I filled my card, but I, you know, it didn't really make a whole lot of money doing anything like that.
Was that the reason you joined the Navy, or did you have other reasons for joining the Navy?
No, sir. The reason I wanted to join prior, but the at the time it was Marine Corps, they wouldn't allow me because I had been involved in a rodeo accident and I had pins mm-hmm. and screws in my arm. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't take me, and I went on continuing to be a cowboy. At this time, I was just working ranches. I wasn't rodeoing anymore. And then eventually I got the phone call from the recruiter and says, okay, it's more common practice now. You can come in.
Right. Well, you know, the SEALs are a real mythic in terms of American culture. Can you tell you how you joined the Navy, and what's the process of becoming, you know, one of those SEALs?
Well, at the time I joined, I went in a program. It was called the Dive Terror Program, to where I could go to boot camp for the Navy. Mm-hmm. And then from there, at the time, you still had to go to, it was called an A school or MOS mm-hmm. to learn your specialty. I was an intelligence specialist, so I went there, learned that. And then from there, I was guaranteed a shot at BUDS. Be able to at least attempt to pass it. Mm-hmm. Then I went, you know, BUDS is 7 months long, and there was definitely plenty of times I felt like I wasn't going to make it, but I tend to think I was just too lazy to get up and find the bell.
So the training is as tough as they say. Can you describe what you had to do to make it as a SEAL, some of the things you had to do?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a lot of physical stuff as far as carrying those big telephone poles that we call logs and running miles on ends while you're constantly wet and sandy. You're always cold. But I think the biggest percentage of making it through BUDS is mental. I mean, because I went in, I could barely make the minimum amount of pull-ups, and I wasn't this huge natural athlete or a stud of any kind. And once they break you down mentally to where you find out your body can do more than your mind ever thought, then you start to progress. And it was just wanting to stay there and that meaning everything to you to where you're just not going to quit.
Right. I would imagine also, which a lot of people may surprise a lot of people, but being a top-notch sniper is more mental, right, than physical. You have to have the right proper mental frame of mind in order to really succeed at it.
Oh, definitely. Being a sniper is a lot more mental because then now it's, you know, being a sniper is a lot more than just being behind the gun. The biggest mm-hmm. portion of your job being a sniper is, you know, the observation skills, being able to stay out and pay attention to everything and then make the right calls at the right time. You're trying to feed back intel to your guys. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot mental.
Right. Well, how did you become a sniper? You're in the military, right? You joined the military. You almost never made it, but you did. And you go through training. Where does the sniper element fit into it?
Well, I was a new guy, so I was not allowed to go to sniper school. I had to prove myself first. They wanted to see if you had the fortitude to be able to make it through the course because it was a stressful course with 50% dropout, but also mm-hmm. see if, you know, I had the maturity to be able to take on that responsibility. Mm-hmm. Once I proved that to my chief, then he nominated me to go to the school when we returned from our first deployment.
Right. How'd you do in the school? Did you excel there? Were you the best?
Oh, no. I was middle of the pack, and, you know, I almost felt out of sniper school, especially when it came to stalking. Yeah, I just sneaking up on the target, wearing your killer suit. I'm not a patient man, but being a sniper is not about patience. It's all about professional discipline, knowing when to take that time and when to pay attention to detail. And when I finally got that through my head, then, you know, I started passing. And like I said, I was middle of the road. And mm-hmm. even, you know, people try to judge the character of a sniper by how many kills they have. But
right.
I think Carlos Hathcock, who has 93 confirmed kills, is the greatest right. sniper of the entire world all through history because of the way he demonstrated it. He did every skill set a sniper has to learn. You know, he stalked in all by himself with little to no technology, poor scopes, and he did his job. He would sneak in for days, take one target out, which meant he had to find him and identify him properly, and then take the shot and sneak out. So you've got these people, you know, like me and others that have hundreds of kills, and that doesn't measure the true greatness of a sniper.
Yeah, right. Ronnie, I got a quick question I'm going to sneak in, if you don't mind, before we take a break. Kyle, what struck me right off the bat was that there was snipers in the Navy, U.S. Navy. Has this been always a part of the Navy culture?
Well, as far as I know, the only snipers in the Navy are the SEALs. But yes, SEALs have always had snipers.
Well, then you mentioned mental toughness. I mean, people talk about kills, but you also miss too, right? I didn't hear much talk about, you know, when you go out and you have a target, you don't automatically hit the target every time, right? There must have been occasions where you failed as a sniper, right? And that must have had some impact on your confidence.
You can be like a baseball player. Sometimes you get in a slump and you're just not going to be able to make that shot. And you have to pull yourself off the scope and have somebody else get down on it.
Right.
Who tells you they made every shot is lying.
Right. That's a good analogy. It's like being a professional athlete in a lot of ways, right?
Yes, sir.
Right. Willie, let's take a break. This is and continue with this fascinating discussion. We'll move on with Chris's tour of duty in Iraq.
Go ahead, please. You bet, Ronnie. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Harib. Our very special guest this evening is Chris Kyle, author of the subject of American Sniper, the autobiography of the most lethal sniper in U.S. military history. Now back to Ron and Mr. Chris Kyle.
Thank you. We're back with Chris, co-author of American Sniper, and the co-authors of Jim DeFelice and Scott McCoon. Usually we try to tell our listeners or ask the guests to explain where you can buy the book, but I imagine your book is pretty well everywhere, in the world. And do you have a website that we could direct our listeners to for more information?
Well, there is an American Sniper website. If you go to it, it's going to direct you straight to the American Sniper Facebook site. But, you know, you go to any Barnes & Noble or Amazon, anything online is probably the easiest because the airports and all the bookstores have been going to, the stock is getting a little low.
Right. Right. Could you give us an estimate of how many books have been sold so far?
As far as the last I knew, which was 2 weeks ago or so, it was over 500,000.
Wow, 500,000 books. That's truly a bestseller. And I should mention that we're going to talk maybe a little bit about this later. You're president of Craft International, which there is a website, www.craftintl.com, right, where they could find more information about your company.
Yes, sir, definitely.
Right. So you went into training, with the SEALs. You went to sniper school, and you have a graduation, I guess, right?
Well, kind of. You're sitting in the classroom. They call you up one at a time, hand you a little certificate, and say, okay, you're a sniper.
Right. And, well, you joined the Navy in 1999. When was this, approximately? I'm trying to put in relationship to the war in Iraq.
Well, when I went to Iraq in 03 for the invasion, when I came back from that deployment, I then went to sniper school. As soon as we got back, you usually have about 4 weeks off from a deployment to, you know, just kind of settle in, get to know your family again a little bit. But the sniper school was going to cut into that, so I had 2 weeks and then rushed right back into sniper school.
Right. Well, you served 4 combat tours, right, in Operation Iraqi Freedom?
Yes, sir.
And elsewhere, right? Well, how many snipers were there? You were one of what? How many snipers approximately were in Iraq serving their country?
Oh, well, there were several SEAL snipers. I don't know exactly how many of us, but then you also had snipers all through the Army and the Marine Corps. Snipers were heavily called on in the time, so they definitely were sending the snipers overseas as fast as they could.
Right. Well, first kill, you know, was truly memorable. It was supposedly a woman who was about to attack a group of U.S. Marines with a hand grenade. Can you tell that experience, you know, that first time that you had to actually perform your duty?
Yes, sir. I was on the sniper rifle in a city, or in a smaller city, but we were overwatching, trying to stay ahead of the Marine Corps as they were advancing on their, you know, the race to Baghdad. We couldn't hardly stay ahead of them, but we were trying to soften up targets, not to make it soft on them or make it safe, but help out as much as we could. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to be on the scope. As the people were coming out to greet the Marine Corps, as they were coming in the city, another woman happened to catch my eye. She was coming out, acting like she was going to greet the Marine Corps, pulled out a grenade, pulled the pin on it, and I wasn't sure what it was exactly at first. I described everything I saw to my chief behind me, was telling him what was going on. He got interested. He got on the scope, started looking at it, and then he told me, you know, it's a Chinese grenade. And wow. She was walking towards the Marines. So he kept hollering at me to shoot. I hesitated. I asked if we couldn't get the Marines on the radio so they could take the shot. You know, I'd never killed anybody at this point. And definitely right. Didn't want the first one to be a woman. But right. We couldn't reach the Marines. So the chief hollered at me and said, you have to do it. You know, in my mind, she was mm-hmm. dead anyway, whether she blew right. herself up and killed a bunch of Marines or I right. shot her. So I right. took the shot.
Well, that was a lot of pressure for you, you know, the first kill. And how far away were you when you took the shot?
It was less than 100 yards.
Wow. What kind of gun did you use? Do you use like a different type of gun depending on the range?
Well, depending on the mission, I'll take a different weapon system. But for this one, I had a 300 Win Mag, and it had a 32 power scope on it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I understand that's the kind of gun you prefer, which was good for you for that particular assignment, right?
Yes, sir, definitely. I mean, didn't need a 300 Win Mag to reach out and touch her there, but it was definitely good to be able to have that high magnification scope out there so I could positively ID what she had and then be able to zoom back out to take the shot.
Well, you had to shoot someone at 100 yards, but you also did one at 2,100 to 100 yards. There was a man with a rocket launcher, and it's described, you know, really, really graphically and dramatically. What kind of gun did you use there? Did you use the same gun?
No, it was a 338 Lapua, mm-hmm. and it just happened to play out the way it did, but, you know, that's definitely not a record-setting shot. There's right. a Brit who, before me, made a 2,500-yard shot with a 50 cal, and then even after I took my shot, a Canadian did it at 2,500, and then a Brit did it at 2,700.
Wow, but it's still an amazing shot any way you look at it. We were making the analogy with a professional athlete. Is there any kind of ritual that you go through before you go out on assignment to get yourself mentally prepared for it?
No, I mean, the only thing I do is you just don't look at them as people. I mean, otherwise, you're going to go crazy. So you just have to look right. at them as if they're the target. They are the ones who are actively trying to kill you and your mm-hmm. comrade. So you're out there not so much as trying to kill someone. You're out there more or less trying to be a guardian angel. You want to make sure everybody that's on your side is coming home, and even if it's, you know, the Iraqi civilians that are out there, you don't want those people getting injured, and then they turn around and hate us even more.
Yes, Right, that's really amazing. What people don't understand, a lot of people may not understand, realize, is that you were a sniper, but you actually were involved in real close combat, right, with the enemy.
Yes,
and
sir.
You braved some, I understand you braved some heavy fire to rescue, you know, some of your Marines that were trapped on the street. Describe that experience. What was that like?
Well, it was definitely confusing. That was the Battle of Fallujah. You didn't know exactly where the shots were coming from, and everyone was confused. So as we came running in, we were getting information from different guys telling us that different story on where the terrorists were, so it was hard to locate them, and everywhere we went, it seemed like we kept finding more and more wounded Marines. So eventually, you know, we finally located where it was coming from, and then found out that what I was told was a group of Marines were pinned down in this one location. So I had another group of Marines with me, and we came up with a plan that we were going to go down, lay down some, you know, fire some,
right,
shoot our guns and get them to keep their heads down so we can get those Marines out of there. Everyone was in favor of it. We started down the alley. Right at that time, at the end of the alley, mm-hmm, one of the terrorists jumped out with a belt-fed machine gun and started shooting at us. You know, some of the Marines who were hanging back a little bit to watch end up taking him down. We all dove back around the corner, checked ourselves for holes, and you know, thought, holy cow, thank you, God.
Wow.
And then kind of took a breather there and went, all right, everybody ready, let's go again. And then took off down there. I started laying down suppressive fire. And then at that point, I realized that with all the confusion, I was the only one that had run back in there. I was all by myself.
Right.
So I just kept shooting as much as I could, told the Marines to get out of there. And then that's when I realized there were two Marines and two reporters, that they came out of there. The last Marine tapped me on the shoulder, said, hey, last man. So I turned to check my flank, and as I did, there was another Marine laying there who had been shot through both legs. So I grabbed him by his wet gear and started dragging him back down the street until I could get back into cover.
Yeah. Ryan, I got a quick one. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to follow up with that. Sadly, you lost two of your close friends. Was that the incident where you did this, where you lost your close friends?
No, sir. Where I lost my buddies was in Ramadi in 06.
And what happened there?
I just picked up Mama Lee, Mark's mom. If we could not have to go through that right now, I would appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We won't talk about it. Willie, you have a question for Chris?
Yeah, I got a quick one for Chris. Why is there no women snipers in the U.S. military? Or is there? The reason I'm asking is because, at the Battle of Stalingrad, in the Second World War, the Russians had trained hundreds of female snipers, and they seem to have the knack for it. Is there a plan to train women as snipers?
Honestly, as far as the rules in America, when it comes down to the women, they are not allowed on front lines, unless the closest they can get to the front lines, you know, are being pilots, which, you know, pilots get shot down. They're right there in the heat of it. But they will not allow a female to be a combat troop on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that will change, Chris?
I'm sure it will. And everything changes over time. I mean, people grow up and mature, and I definitely think it'll change.
Right. And that's just really interesting. The really interesting thing is this name, the devil. You were nicknamed the devil by the enemy, which I guess is an honor on that, because they feared you so much. When did that come about, and what did you feel like when you heard that the enemy knew who you were?
Well, that was in 06 in Ramadi. And when I first heard it, I definitely felt good that, you know, they had a nickname right. for me. They had a bounty out for me. And I thought, great, I'm doing my job so well. I'm getting in their heads and affecting them. So, and they realize it too. So that definitely right. made me feel good. But also, you know, in the back of my mind, I started thinking, okay, now I need to start watching my back.
Right. And right. Were there any, did you hear of any reports where they were going out of their way to target you specifically because they feared you so much and you're doing so much damage to them?
Well, the only way they could identify me were after we would leave an occupied house that, mm-hmm. you know, once we go into a house and make it our sniper hide, we have to take care of those people in there. We have to allow them to eat and do their day-to-day stuff as long as they stay inside, and then we're now responsible for their safety.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those people inside the house would see me walking around without my long-sleeve shirt on and just my short-sleeve shirt and body armor, so they could see the red Crusader Cross tattoo I had on my arm, which wow. is where the name came from, because, I picked the Crusader Cross tattoo because mm-hmm. I am a Christian, and I wanted it to be known, but I also started looking at, okay, well, if I'm going to do a cross, what kind of cross do I want?
Mm-hmm.
And then I started thinking of the Templar Knights, and they were brave, fierce warriors,
right.
and that's what I strove to be.
Right. Well, you mentioned the bounty. I believe the bounty was like $80,000. Are these guys like the mafia? I mean, is that bounty still in effect? Do they, you know, hold grudges like that against you?
As far as I know, no. But, you know, I'm definitely not going to be stupid about it and walk around with my,
right.
my nose up in the air and ignore everything.
Right.
But,
right.
you know, I went out there and took out low-level targets. And mm-hmm. if they really want to hit someone, I would imagine they're going to hit the guys who have really mm-hmm. put the hurt on them and taken out their leaders and some high-profile ops.
Right. Willie, let's take a break, and we'll go into our last segment with Chris in his fascinating interview.
You bet, Ronnie. What an intriguing story he has to tell. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsick and Will Rib. Our very special guest this evening is Chris Kyle. Now back to Ron and Chris for the remainder of the program.
Thank you, Willie. And we're back with Chris Kyle, co-author of American Sniper, the autobiography of the most lethal sniper in U.S. military history. It's a best-selling book. You can get anywhere in the world. It's sold over 500,000 copies. That shows you something about the book. And Chris is president of Kraft International, so you can get more information about Chris's current activities at www.kraftintl.com. On that. Now, do you have a Facebook page, Chris, or a Twitter?
The only thing I have is that American Sniper Facebook page, and I rarely even have time to look at that.
Right, right. On that. Getting back to your service in Iraq, how is a kill confirmed? A so-called kill confirmed. What's the process for that?
Well, every time I went out and had a confirmed kill, I was never alone. I always had other guys with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had the witnesses that were there, and usually there were several. And then after every shot, I had to go back, and it's called a shooter statement. I had to mm-hmm. write down exactly what time of day it was, where
right.
it was, what the guy was doing, how far away, what rifle I shot him with, all the way down to the grain of the bullet that I used on him, and it was an extremely detailed report to
mm-hmm.
be able to show what had happened and where and why.
Right. Well, you're a young man. You're about 38 years old, and you went in 99, and I understand that you stayed for 10 years, and then the military, which is 4 tours of duty, I could imagine just, you know, how stressful that could be, but it also took a toll on your family, and you're very honest about this. You talk about this this experience. Can you explain what kind of impact it had on you and your wife, Taya?
Definitely. I mean, being in the military, whether, you know, you spend your extended periods of time deployed, whether it's 6 months or 10 months, whatever it may be for us, You know, I know there's other guys who do a year, year and a half. But even when we go home then, our training, very, very little of it is done in the local area. So we have to travel around the United States to train, and we're never home. In fact, the last 3 years I was in, I was home for 6 months. Mm-hmm. So it definitely causes a lot of hardships on the family, and especially when I had two young kids that were at home. You know, I left 1 week after my son was born for a deployment, and then deployed again 2 days after my daughter was born. Mm-hmm. So it definitely caused a lot of stress. And also, just being a SEAL, we had 95% divorce rate.
Wow. Does the country take good care of its veterans when it's coming back? You know, when they have served so many tours of duties. I know there's a lot of people that come back with psychological problems, not only as well as physical problems. Do you think that there's enough attention paid to returning veterans after they've served their country?
Well, that's one of the things I've been using all these interviews to do, is kind of stand up on my soapbox and say, hey, you know, these people meet you at the airport or wherever they may be. They see you in uniform. They say thank you. But, you know, in today's world, there's a lot of lip service. So let's take it an extra step farther and show our thanks. You know, just do random acts of kindness, whether you give to a charity or if you want to just no money at all, you can buy them a meal, you know, or bring them one over, mow their yard, do their laundry, just babysit so they can take a nap or go on a date, you know, just help them out. And that would mean the world to these guys. And as far as the guys with PTSD, I mean, there needs to be more awareness about this throughout, you know, all the population, that these guys are not to be looked down on and frowned upon. They're not to be treated as outcasts. They have an issue that they can work through, and we need to do it for them, because or at least help them with, I mean, it's our duty now. They're well to die for us. The least we can do is help them out. So just, I mean, and these guys, well, girls, they can still be trusted.
Right. Well, and you're involved with disabled veterans, so it's also people with physical disabilities as well, right? Talk a little bit about your work with that and what more needs to be done to help our brave returning soldiers that are disabled.
Yeah, these men and women are coming back, and some of them are missing arms and legs or disfigured in certain ways. We're taking them out on these retreats, and whether we go fishing, hunting, or we just go hang out at a ranch, and just a big group of us, you know, and me being prior military and a few other prior military guys, but then all these other guys, because they're still active, and just try to let them know that, hey, we still love you, you're still part of the team, and I'm just showing you that we're here for you, and we're going to do whatever it takes. You know, as much as I can do, I will do.
Hey, hi, Chris, I got another one. Any kills that you regret, and were they all instantaneous?
No, not all of them were instantaneous, and no, none of them I regret. I made complete positive that before I took that shot, that it was going to be a good one, because I do not want to come home and spend the rest of my life behind bars.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Now, you spent 10 years in the military. I would imagine you must miss the military, right? The camaraderie and some of the other things that go with it, right?
Definitely. I mean, you miss the culture of being in. It's definitely it's definitely different than being a civilian. It's guys who not trying to bow up their chest and measure each other out. We all know that we're all there for the same thing. We harass each other. We're hard on each other. And if you get in an argument and it comes down to it where you got to exchange blows, you do it, and then you go drink beer together. And, you know, the biggest thing you miss are definitely the guys. Yeah, they become family.
Yeah, right. Would you go back, even given the stress that it caused on your marriage and the hardship it caused for you in terms of family life, would you go back into the military if you were called to service?
Well, depends on how bad it was. I would hope they wouldn't call me, but if it was bad enough to where my country needed me, then yes, I would go back.
Right. Well, yeah, you know, I think this is important. We're talking about returning soldiers and you know, some of the problems they have, and why it's important to take care, take more interest and care of them. What about people out there, you know, Americans that are listening to the radio show? How can they get involved in their communities? Are there any groups that they can get involved with that they can join and you know, support their troops?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm here in Texas, and there's an organization called FITCO Cares, the Hero Project. It's F-I-T-C-O, cares.org. And one of the things when I got out, and I got extremely depressed because, you know, I resented my wife for making me get out, and then I was giving up, or not giving up, but failing my country for not continuing on. But, you know, as soon as I started working out again, I got my head straight. And so I thought, let's start doing this for these guys. And, you know, if they're disfigured, they don't want to go to a gym and people stare at them. And if they're having problems or because they're out of shape, then they don't want to go get made fun of at a gym either. So we're putting brand new gym equipment into these vets' homes, but also providing them with a personal trainer if they need it, a therapist if they'll accept it. And it's not just stopping at the physical part. But then there's several other organizations out there. You've got America's Mighty Warriors, and then Troops First. There's so many organizations that are out there, and they're doing it the right way without paying these huge salaries to where the money is actually going to the troops. And, you know, like I said, you don't even have to be involved with the organization. If you want to donate, please do. But if not, I don't care if you're from Canada, Israel, wherever you may be. Those men and women are putting their lives on the line for you. Just show them a random act of kindness. No matter what country you're from, these men and women are putting their lives on the line for you. We owe it to them now.
Yeah, right on that. And we appreciate your being on the show, Chris. We can go on and talk more about this fascinating subject. And but you know, once again, we want to stress, you know, what Chris was talking about is to help our returning veterans, no matter where they are, that have served their country. And you served your country well, Chris, and it was an honor to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, sir. I really appreciate y'all giving me this opportunity.
Right.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
No problem.
Well, Willie,
Wow, Ronnie, we needed more time. We needed about 5 hours with Chris.
Yeah, right.
But he
was passionate about you know, the veterans that are coming home, and I watch you know, a lot of stories on TV, and I can understand why he is that way. And I think we got to do more.
Well,
more.
You know,
that's the message that I got out of this. I got out of this interview. And what about you, Willie?
Well, you know, I learned he had a job to do, and he did it well. And I liked his analogy about a being it's like baseball. He would have been a great slugger if he would have played ball. I'm telling you. Well, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beats History segment of the month segment. Dateline, 1932, 80 years ago. In 1932, in a crime that captured the attention of the entire nation, Charles Lindbergh III, the 20-month-year-old son of aviation hero, Charles Lindbergh, is kidnapped from the family's New Jersey mansion in Hopeful, New Jersey. Even Al Capone offers his help from prison. A fellow by the name of Bruno Hauptmann, a carpenter, was eventually convicted and was electrocuted in 1935. Any comments, Ronnie?
Yeah, in the aftermath of that crime, Willie, that was the most notorious crime of the 1930s. Kidnapping became a federal offense. That's how big the case was. But, you know, it was the first crime of the century in the mass media age. Now we have a crime of a century, you know, every year. You know, it's O.J. Simpson, Scott Peterson, the Anthony woman, you know, we had Jorn Vandersloot and all that. So it's really really interesting to go back, you know, in time to reflect about that. And you said, I think we talked about this, you think Hauptmann might have got a bum deal on this thing.
I think so. You know, a lot of people are saying that he was convicted under very slim evidence, and he went to the electric chair for it. But there's a lot of speculation on this, that's for sure.
Well, now, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for April the 12th, 2012. Our guests will be authors John Land and Robert Fitzpatrick, who wrote the award-winning book titled Betrayal, Whitey Bulger and the FBI Agent Who Fought to Bring Him Down. It's going to be another great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss that one. We'd like to remind you, Ron and I would invite you again next week on the Artist First World Radio Network. Now, for all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are, we'd like to thank all of you out there for tuning in tonight. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chapsik and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.